I am Shusara Kona Kumara. Welcome to Satsang. You are beginningless. You are endless. You are divine. Good evening, everyone. Thank you so much for joining us for Satsang tonight. We're going to go ahead and get started, so take a nice deep breath and I will clear the space. Mother, Father, God, through the Great Central Sun Hierarchy, through the Office of the Christ, through the Order of Melchizedek, I call upon Archangel Michael to bring the sapphire blue ray. Cut away, cut away, cut away anything in all of our four lower vehicles not emanating directly from our I Am presence. I now call on Archangel Zachiel, Keeper of the Violet Flame. Blaze, blaze, blaze the violet flame through all of our four lower bodies. Transmute, transmute, transmute all the psychic debris Michael has cut free. I now bring forth the invincible ring pass knot and the mirror blue light of invisibility to completely surround each of us. And I call forth a shaft of pure Christ light, one to surround each of us, and I ask that they be brought to the center of the earth where I call on Archangel Gabriel to seal them. And I ask that the legions of Michael completely surround each tube of light. And now I ask that our vibrations be raised high above the psychic and astral worlds to the highest realm of illumined truth we each can attain at this time. And now, Mother, Father, God, we place ourselves in service to you and to humanity. We ask that only that which is direct from you be permitted into our perceptions and that all else of the lower mind be kept out. And we ask that only that which is direct from you be permitted through us. And because we have asked this, we consider it so. So be it. Good evening, everybody. Take a nice deep breath for me and come back into the space. Hello, hello. Good to see everybody tonight. Okay, so I have something a little specific that I wanted to talk about to start off with tonight. Let's see where it heads. I wanted to start off with an aspect of the work that we do here at the Kumara Center that is very specific to our path, is very mental and very psychological. And because it's such an important component in the beginning of a seeker's journey, at least the aspect of their journey that pertains to the work that we do, I think that what happens for so many people is that it's very easy to get locked into that part of the journey. But the psychological level that we do concerning dissolution work, seeing between polarities, is not an end in and of itself. It's meant to bridge you from where you currently function from as a predominantly unconscious human, we'll say, into a being of greater consciousness and greater conscious awareness. It's meant to bridge that. Because you can't, it's not as simple as saying, oh, okay, so we'll take on some mental understandings of what the lowercase s self is versus the uppercase s self. And as soon as we have those understandings kind of locked into our brains, we're good to go. I mean, it obviously is not that simple. Or humanity as a whole would not be dealing with everything it's dealing with currently. It is a process. It is a process that takes lifetimes, sometimes thousands of lifetimes, to wake up to one's eternal self. And one of the traps that I see most often is in the seeker who gets mired and stuck in wanting to perpetuate the psychological aspect of their journey. What does that look like? That looks like a person who is maybe addicted to their processing work. Maybe they it's their go-to for every little thing that goes wrong to sit down and go into self-inquiry and process it out. Is that a bad thing? Absolutely not. But can it be overused and be detrimental ultimately? Yes, absolutely. Right? It's always about discernment and balance. It can also present as a seeker who really is looking constantly, of course, as an ego. The ego looking constantly, strictly for reinforcement of the story, whatever that story is for the person. So in these cases, the seeker just wants someone. Now in this case, regarding this work, it would be me, right, as the guide or the teacher. So the seeker would want to elicit me as guide or teacher to continually engage in whatever the seeker's story is. I have this problem, I have this problem, and this is happening, and this always happens, and this never stops, and I can't seem to get beyond this, and this, and this, and I. And so whenever we hear in our own self-talk, or if we're listening to another, when the talk is completely focused in I or me or mine, you know that that's strictly program running, right? And here's the thing, it's not a bad thing, certainly in the beginning when you start doing this level of work, it's all about your stories, right? Because how else are we going to become that bridge from unconsciousness into conscious awareness? We have to start with the stories, and we have to start with getting in there, allowing them to be real for us as we do the work around them, right? Because if they're real for us, then we can truly experience the emotion that's trapped, the energetics underneath the emotion that's trapped within our four lower body structure. And it requires that to be able to bring stuff to light so that then it can be transmuted and released. So obviously it's a very good thing and a very necessary thing. However, if we aren't utilizing the techniques that have been given by the guide or the teacher to systematically and consistently detach from those stories, then we are doing ourselves a great disservice as seeker. Because if it's only about getting of what's going on and then just using what we're seeing as more reason to tell more story. Oh, I understand now. I did this because my father did this. And so that's what happened. And now this is, so now I end up doing the same thing, and I always do the same thing, and I guess I have my dad to blame for that. And you see, that's just another level of story. And if nothing else, it's going to continue to reinforce the the story you were telling yourself originally. Understandable? Yes? Yes? Good. So what do we do? Well, very simple. The point is you do your work so that the ultimate thing is to see beyond the story, right? We're always looking for what lies beyond that which we're aware of currently. So in the beginning, you're not aware of the certain triggers. You're not aware of why you react certain ways and the patterning that lies underneath it. So the work initially is to start getting in there to bring that to light. Wonderful. So we get to that point. And then now the next thing to do is to go in deeper and now pull in the teachings, right? The very first of which is that you are beginningless, endless, formless, single being, knowledge bliss. That one teaching should be the foremost thing in your mind all the time, because that's what it all comes back to. The point of going in and routing out stories and going through all of the emotional trauma and all of the energetic garbage that we're carrying for, the point of it is so that we can release it and return to that which we are. Beginningless and endless. How can you have a story if you're beginningless and endless, right? Or how could you be just one story? Or how could you just be a handful of stories? If you're all that is, well, you're all of it, but you're also nothing. If you're all that is, that's no one thing, is it? Nothing. So to lock ourselves into a space where we, you know, the ego wants to do it, you understand? And so here's part of it. Part of it is the understanding of how the mind functions. And that's one of the things that I'm very particular about when I work with anybody, is constantly showing them, that's the ego speaking. Oh, any of my students will tell you, I say this all the time, spoken like a true ego. Yeah, spoken like a true ego. And for good reason, because these things that are spoken, that's exactly what it is. It's just the ego speaking. It's nothing outside of that, right? Nothing. Is it beneficial for you if I allow that and then just continue to entertain the monkey mind, you know, the egoic self with, yeah, let's talk more about your story? There are times when it makes sense, right? If I can see that you haven't gotten deep enough into a certain thing, you're skimming the surface and there's obviously a lot more going on. Yeah, we need to get into that story deeper. But once it's seen, and once you've done work around it and you've gone, you've found all the pairs of opposites and you've brought them together through meditation, you've owned it all the opposites, you've brought it together, right, to transmute it back to its perfect nature, to let that energy go. At that point, is there a reason to continue talking about the story? No, there really isn't. Because at that point, the only thing it's going to do is tempt you back into identification. The story has to be released. Now, that's not easy, is it, on the side of the ego? That's terrifying, right? It may seem easy enough the first couple, but you keep going and it's like, oh, there's another piece I have to let go of now. Oh, there's another piece. And every one of these pieces is a part of the jigsaw puzzle of the matrix of the personality. So the ego catches on really quick. If I let too many of these go, then what's left of me? And that's not something it's going to be comfortable with, certainly. But that's the point, right? The point as seeker. You didn't come to this path, especially this path. You didn't come to this path for a therapist. You came to this path for liberation. How many people do you know who have been in psychotherapy for decades, right? Years and years, and there's kind of no end point. Is that accurate? Most of the time, yeah. Why? Because they're never going to get to the point where the patient feels normal. Whatever normal means to you. Because you can't, through psychotherapy alone, you can't get to a place where you surrender to all that is and release all that you think yourself to be. Psychotherapy is about the exact opposite. It's about, let's keep reinforcing the story. Let's keep reinforcing the story. Let's work it so that you can function while you hold the story. And then let's teach you techniques so that you can function outside of the story, hopefully. And if it's not outside of the story, let's at least teach you techniques so that you can calm the story for the majority of the time. Like, that's the focus of psychotherapy. And it has its place. It has a very important place, don't get me wrong. And a lot of what I do would be considered that, right? But if you can't go beyond it, then let me rephrase that. If you're not searching to go beyond it, then you're not a spiritual seeker. You're an ego looking for therapy. That's not a spiritual seeker. The spiritual seeker is the one who steps forward and says, it feels like I'm my pain, right? But something deeper inside of me has some level of recognition that I'm not that. Or at least I heard somewhere that I'm not that, and it intrigued me enough that I want to know what that is. What is that? Or I heard someone say, this world is a dream. Or I heard someone say, well, we're all living in a matrix. And something in there resonated, and I need to know what that is. Right? There's a seeker. Because that person's saying, okay, you know, it may be scary. Obviously, I don't even have a clue what I'm walking into, but there's something there, and I need to do it. It's a little different than someone who's just experiencing, say, massive depression and is just scrambling to find someone to help them. All right. Now, doing spiritual work can start that way. For some, it does. It starts because they have hit like rock bottom and they want help. But there's something in them that is not just seeking therapy, or else they wouldn't be looking for a quote-unquote spiritual guide, right? There's already something at play there. So it's my job as a guide and a teacher to ensure that I'm serving my students and anyone who happens to listen to my teachings to the best of my ability. And part of that is me monitoring myself to make sure that I'm not just humoring the ego in my work with a student, right? That's just not, it's not going to benefit anybody. If anything, it's detrimental to the student to continue doing it. Okay, any questions on that at all? That all seems pretty clear? Yeah? Okay, good. So, my view just changed. I'm seeing everyone really weird now. Okay, so I wanted to do something a little different tonight. I want to read you something. So, forgive me for a second. I have my glasses on. Or I won't be able to read anything. All right, so for those of you, well, you know, wherever you happen to be hearing this from, radio, live, YouTube, whatever, go ahead and just close your eyes. I just want you to listen. This is a passage from the Upanishads, which is one of the works that our path really refers to a lot. Not necessarily specifically, like I refer to text, because I really don't do that, but what I'm reading this tonight because those of you who have spent any time with me or those of you who have listened to our BBS programs long enough, you're going to recognize our path in this little chapter. It's a couple pages. Okay. So just get nice and settled and have a listen. So this is a conversation throughout the Upanishads going on between Arjuna and Krishna. It's beautiful. Starts with Arjuna. of those steadfast devotees who love you and those who seek you as the eternal formless reality, who are the more established in yoga? And Krishna says, those who set their hearts on me and worship me with unfailing devotion and faith are more established in yoga. As for those who seek the transcendental reality without name, without form, contemplating the unmanifested beyond the reach of thought and of feeling, with their senses subdued and mind serene and striving for the good of all beings, they too will verily come unto me. Yet hazardous and slow is the path to the unrevealed, difficult for physical creatures to tread. But they for whom I am the supreme goal, who do all work renouncing self, small s, for me, and meditate on me with single-hearted devotion, bhakti, these I will swiftly rescue from the fragments cycle of birth and death, for their consciousness has entered into me. Still your mind in me, still your intellect in me, and without doubt you will be united with me forever. If you cannot still your mind in me, learn to do so through the regular practice of meditation. If you lack the will for such self-discipline, engage yourself in my work, for selfless service can lead you at last to complete fulfillment. If you are unable to do even this, surrender yourself to me, disciplining yourself and renouncing the results of all your actions. Remember, no attachment to the outcome. Better indeed is knowledge than mechanical practice. Better than knowledge is meditation. But better still is surrender of attachment to results, because there follows immediate peace. The one I love who is incapable of ill will, who is friendly and compassionate, living beyond the reach of I and mine and of pleasure and pain, patient, contented, self-controlled, firm in faith, with all their heart and all their mind given to me. With such as these, I am in love. Not agitating the world or by it agitated, they stand above the sway of elation, competition, and fear. That one is my beloved. They are detached, pure, efficient, impartial, never anxious, selfless in all their undertakings. They are my devotees, very dear to me. That one is dear to me who runs not after the pleasant or away from the painful, grieves not, lusts not, but lets things come and go as they happen. That devotee who looks upon friend and foe with equal regard, who is not buoyed up by praise nor cast down by blame, alike in heat and cold, pleasure and pain, free from selfish attachments. The same in honor and dishonor, quiet, ever full, in harmony everywhere, firm in faith, such a one is dear to me. Those who meditate upon this immortal Dharma as I have declared it, full of faith and seeking me as life's supreme goal, are truly my devotees, and my love for them is very great. Okay, again from the Upanishads, that may have even come out of the Gita. I honestly don't know. Since it's Arjuna and Krishna, that may be a Bhagavad Gita thing. But regardless, I'm not a theologian around sacred texts, right? But I have glasses. But I do understand what I'm reading. So let's go back to what we just looked at. All right, it's brilliant, Pyelyan. I'm going to call on you because I want you to tell me kind of what you experienced in listening to that passage that was relatable to you concerning your journey the path that we, as we walk it here at the Kamara Center.
Relatable to me. For me, listening to it, what I found relatable is that it's, I guess now we're trying to, I guess, master not having, not seeing it as good or bad, not labeling things, and just whatever it is, just trying to just go at it, you know, and like see through it, but also figure out like what's going on here, trying to see like all that are involved, what's going on with you, not getting caught up in it. And then, you know, like, and then not seeing it as, you know, like, so if you were to tell someone what was going on, then they might say, you know, oh, that's so sad to hear. Then it's like, no, you know, and it's kind of like, I'm not labeling it either way. I just know it's something that I need to look at and deal with and see through and everything, you know? So that's what I found relatable.
Yeah. That's like, excellent. Good thing. Point right there. Because isn't that a beautiful thing? Not an easy point to get to, but when you actually can say, if someone, you know, I would tell everybody, you know, don't share your personal stories with anybody when you're doing this work, because no one has the capacity to relate to you on the level you need them to relate to you at. So it's not helping any, but let's just say you're new and you didn't know that. So you're sharing. Right. So someone hears your story and says, oh, that's so sad. And like you said, Pielian, your version of it is kind of like, well, no, like I don't see it that way. It's an opportunity, right? And that has to become the all-pervasive basis of your functioning. There's no poor me going on in this, ever, right? How can there be? I'm the one who created it. So if you want to call me a masochist, apparently I'm a masochist, but I'm the one who created it for myself. So no one did this to me. No one out there has passed some kind of judgment on me that I need to be punished or that I need to suffer or that I need to go through hard times. That's all me, right? Do you understand? You know, it's funny. I don't think people have the slightest understanding of how much love it takes to allow that in an individual. People want to say, if God loved me, then God would take my pain away. And what I'm going to say is, God loves you so much, he's allowing you to have your own pain. Right? Isn't that the truth? To say, you are me. You are me. And I've given you self-direction, self-will. Yeah. Now, if you choose to take it in a route that you end up getting trapped in this cycle, this program, it's your choice, but it's all experience. There's no good or bad in eternity. There's no good or bad. It's all just experience. You look at it from a data set. I'd love to use computer terminology when I talk about God, because it's so perfect to me. Because God is such an impersonal thing, ultimately. Right? Humans like to personify God and to make God into a man or make God into an old man with a beard or make God into whatever they want to make it into. Sometimes make God into a goddess and the female and the earth and whatever else, right? But we love to personify it. Why? Because who's comfortable with the concept of God that is outside of, like, you, the people would say, I feel weird calling God an it. It has to be a he or a she, because if it's not a male or a female, like, it's wrong to say it. And I was, I mean, from the time I was little, I was like, why? God doesn't feel male or female to me. Not at all. Maybe a blending of both, but then what is it? It's a he, she? what is it at that point? Who knows? To me, God was light, right? Light, pure light, which is pure love. It's pure consciousness. That's all I could see God as from the time I was little. Like, that I understood. Carried that forward from many lifetimes, I'm sure. So as humans, like, we have to personify this thing, right? And because of it, we're incapable of kind of seeing that this creator that is not separate from you, that is you, you know, lives as you, in you, through you, that this being is loving itself. It's not even enough to say it loves you, because there's no differentiation between you and the creator. It's all the same thing. It loves itself, right? It loves itself so much that it created more of itself to spread itself around and to have experience with itself. And from that point, can we not relate it to a computer system? Of course. Data points. Compiling data. Try this, and when this happens, what's the effect? And then that happens, and pull the data together again. Okay, so let's try this, and when we do this, then what does that happen? Oh, okay, that's what happens. Pull it together. Pull it all together. There's your data point. So why can't God just be that? Well, we're not comfortable with that because it's not personal enough. Right? We want the God that feels like Jesus. That's not wrong, because that aspect is there too. But when we get locked into wanting the God that looks like Jesus, then it's so easy to continue to perpetuate all of our victim stories, you see, because now we want the loving. We say, well, but God's a loving God, and if God was a loving God, then why would God let this happen to me? Because this bad thing is happening to me, so it shows that God doesn't love me. There's nothing that could be further from the truth than that. Absolutely ridiculous. No one has judged you. No one has found you wanting. No one has found you less than. You are perfect. Absolutely perfect. Consciousness is enslaved in a program and identified with that program, but the perfection that you are has never gone anywhere. It is beginningless, endless, formless, single, being, knowledge, bliss. It never changes. That's what's real. That's the only thing that's real. And you're right now experiencing the exact opposition to that. You are experiencing the shadow side of what is real. You are experiencing shadow. You may see a shadow on the ground, but what's it made out of? Absence of light. Okay. Okay. But how real is it? Well, I can see it. Can you pick it up? Not unless you're Peter Pan, right? Stitch his shadow back onto his foot because that sucker got away from him, right? And isn't that maybe true of all of us? Maybe all those little sucker shadows have gotten away and they're running rampant. And you have the divine capacity to reel it back in. Yeah. And see it for what it is, a play of light. A play of light. If you look at a shadow, is it truly the absence of light? I mean, look at this with me for a minute. This is important. It's because the mind is so polarized, it only thinks of black and white. So if I say, here's light, here's shadow, you're going to say, well, one side is light, the other side is dark. Okay, so what does dark mean? You're going to say, well, it's the absence of light. But is a shadow void of light? Not normally. And if it was void of light, completely void of light, chances are there wouldn't be any light. Because a shadow always has some sense of light to it as well. It's not completely void. You really sit with that and look at it, you'll see it. If you think of your shadow on the ground, you can still, let's say you're standing in the street and the sun is in a certain position and it's casting a shadow. You can still see the definition of the street in your shadow, right? And the only way you could do that is if there was light being cast on that from around the perimeter of the shadow. So is it devoid? No, right? I love this because it shows that there's this beautiful sliding scale where everything is somewhere in here, and every moment you're moving one direction or another direction on this sliding scale from the negative pole to the positive pole. But there's everything in between. And as human beings functioning unconsciously, we get so locked in so easily to it's this or it's that, right? So look at right now, perfect example. Right now, all the drama going on around football players taking a knee in protest. And how many people out there were so triggered by it that it's literally as black and white as, if you take a knee, you're unpatriotic. If you take a knee, you don't love our country. That's polarized. That is highly polarized. No capacity to see there's more to this story than just the one aspect that's triggering you. What's their story? Doesn't matter what your perception of the story is. They're the ones who are protesting. So let's hear it through their perception. You see, this is where we fall short as a species. How many people out there, how many world leaders out there are willing to put themselves in the shoes of the other side so that they can attempt to see through their perception? If I can get in there and see it as you, and of course I hold my own perception, now I have an opportunity to kind of bring them together and use some really good rational mental skills to come up with a solution that can work for everybody. But no, I mean, I'm locked into my thought patterns and this other person's, with their country's locked into their thought patterns, so we're just gonna duke it out. Now we have bombs. Great. The person with the biggest bomb wins. But nobody wins. No one's ever gonna win like that. Shouldn't be about winning, should it? You know, who needs to win if we can both agree that it's ridiculous? Right? No one needs to win if we just agree on whatever it is we're going to agree on. But even the mind can't be happy with that, because someone's got to win. Winning feels good, right? Losing doesn't feel good. Who wants to be a loser? I don't know. What does it matter? It's just something else you're going to identify yourself with. So what does it matter? All right, so back to the Gita. And I have to correct myself here. The Gita is part of Vedanta, not part of the Upanishads. So my correction for myself there. But back to what we were reading. It shows in that passage that I read, it's like completely in alignment with the work that we do. What's it saying in there? It's saying, you know, don't attach to outcomes. I thought that was perfect. How much more clear could that be? Don't attach to any outcomes. And for how many seekers is that maybe the single most difficult thing to learn to transcend is the attachment to an outcome? It's huge, absolutely huge. I mean, let's look at it this way. Let's give you an example. You have a desire, let's say, and it's truly like a heartfelt desire to be of service to people. And you decide you're going to start some organization, and your thing will be being of service. And that's beautiful. So you get started. And then over the course of time, you gain an audience, or you gain some people who want to support your endeavor. And so you begin to grow and get a little attention and whatever else. And now you start moving into a different arena. So in the beginning, there was no, you were just happy to show up, right? You were just happy to be there, to give from your heart. That was all you cared about. And it was a beautiful thing because you experienced others and how they were impacted by the service you rendered. And it was just beautiful, and you didn't care about how they would praise you. It didn't matter. You were just so full in your heart in hearing their positive experiences and how they came out the other side and how they would share that it had impacted them. It was all you needed. Well, now your organization has grown some, and you have rules in place, and you have, you know, people who are sponsoring your work, or, you know, however we want to talk, supporting it financially, and you have, say, a financial backer in place, right? And now the challenge is different. Now the challenge is, how do you hold on to what was so pure in the beginning after incorporating all of this highly polarized stuff from the world? How do you do that and not be attached? Not easy. If I'm going to say, I'm going to show up and do my thing, and I don't feel I should charge anything for it, I just want to give to the people. It's all I ever want to do, give to the people. And then you have your business manager who says, well, I agree. I think that's beautiful. However, you know, we pay X amount of dollars for our building every month. And we pay X amount of dollars to heat it, and we pay X amount of dollars to have the water running. So somewhere this money has to come from. So I think, you know, it makes sense to just charge for your work. Okay, is that okay? Sure, that's okay. There's nothing wrong with that. Don't get me wrong. Nothing wrong with that. The only time there's something wrong with that is if in the process of doing it, you lose the vantage point that you had when you started. Because now, if you're doing it for the money, now your concern is, oh gosh, now we have a building we have to maintain. So now the pressure's on to make sure that there's enough coming in to maintain the building, because if we don't have the building, then I can't do my work. And if I can't do my work, I can't reach people. And see, it's very subtle how this little monster gets in there. Because it seemed like it came in from a very benevolent place, right? We want to support the work. So in order to support the work, let's give you a better space to do it and give you, you know, whatever. But now it costs money. So now we have to change the way you do your work. And before long, you find yourself working for the money. And the whole thing you were doing in service and having that back and forth with the person gets lost, or it comes secondary to the money. That's attachment, yeah? How easy is it for the person to recognize it and go, okay, so here's the deal. We have a building, and we have to have it heated, and we have to have water, but I'm not charging anymore. Sorry. Y'all are gonna have to figure that out, because I'm not doing it, because I'm just not called to do that. Would that work? I guess you're going to find out. But it takes detachment, like true detachment, to even be in a space where you're willing to give it a shot to see if it's going to work out. You see? Maybe it will. Maybe something else is going to come in and surprise the heck out of it. You had no idea it was ever there, and all of a sudden you have a benefactor who shows up and you're like, I don't care what you do. I just want to support the work. So, you know, let me write you a check every month for $1,000. Would that work for you? And you'd be like, yay, that'd be fabulous, right? Or maybe it's the opposite. Maybe you say, I can't do it like that, so I'm not going to. And then a couple months down the road, your person or group of people that support your work say, yeah, I don't think we're going to support this anymore, because if we're not getting any return on our investment, it doesn't really make sense to do it. oh, that's good. See, now you're seeing you've got very different mindsets at play. You've got someone who's truly just wants to be a service and doesn't care. They put everything they had into it. That's fine. And then, but then you have others who say, well, if I put a dollar value on it, I expect a certain return. And so I'm going to base everything on my return on investment, right? It's a very worldly kind of thing. Is it a bad thing? No, it's not a bad thing. Not a bad thing. But a completely different mindset. A lot of attachment there, an awful lot of attachment there. How many people get like overwrought if their 401k takes a 10% dip in a month? Yeah. I lost $4,000 in my 401k last month. Yeah. And it's like the world's coming to an end. That's attachment. Very strong attachment. So the attachment end is super, super, super important concerning where we're at, how we're going to do this work, how we're going to move forward in this work. And it starts with detaching from your own stories, right? Being capable of detaching from, I'm this. Let's pick whatever that's going to be. I'm what? I'm a Christian. I'm a Muslim. I'm Jewish. I'm an atheist. I'm undecided. I'm agnostic. I'm a man. I'm a woman. I'm a mother. I'm a father. I'm a friend. I'm a boss. I'm an employee. I'm a teacher. I'm a student. Keep going, right? I'm manic depressive. I'm hyperactive. I'm bored. I'm lonely. I'm broke. That could be a statement. That could be a statement, right? I'm pathetically poor. That's more of an identification. I'm jealous. I am conceited. I'm aggressive. I'm mean. I'm nasty. I'm a saint. I'm a sinner. I'm exhausted. That could be a statement of fact too. Or I'm so over this. There we go. That's a good one. That's a good identifier right there. I'm so over this, which is proven point that you're so not over it. The fact that you have to say it. I'm God. Ooh, could that be one? Maybe, maybe. If you're all things, you're nothing. So you're nothing too. Nothing, no thing, nothing. So to hold, even to hold on to I am God can be an identifier that will trap you, right? So to do the greatest work, the great, to walk the path of the great undoing, the great unlearning, means being conscious every day of the way you're presenting and the way you're speaking and the way you're even engaging with those who are in place to help you. You have to come at this work from an impersonal place. There are times for it to be really super personal because it has to be. Remember, I'll say to you over and over again, the only way out is through it. That's exactly what I'm talking about. In order to reach the space of true equanimity, to reach the space where everything is impersonal, it has to be highly personal first. There's no getting around that. You've got to walk that out where it's all highly, highly personal. You do the work around it from that space, and that's what allows for the release of the trapped energy. And then that release of the trapped energy, you become more impersonal. It's just a natural way that it all happens. It's not something you make happen. It just naturally happens. But if you're spending your time just mired in your own self-pity, there's no walking out of that. There's no walking out of that. So for, you know, in the world of psychology, I mean, they would say like a healthy ego doesn't wallow in self-pity. The healthy ego can swing itself out, basically. Pull yourself up by your bootstraps, right? Okay, but the reality of that, and I don't disagree with that. I don't disagree with that because that is true of this paradigm. But remember, you as seeker who would listen to this show are looking to transcend this reality. So what functions here is not the rule book that you're going to follow. You are here to master the world, yes, but you're here to transcend the world. And in the process of transcending it, you will learn to master it. They go hand in hand. It's your focus has to be ultimately the transcending of the state of consciousness that you're currently functioning from. That's the goal. Not, you know, make me feel good 5 minutes from now. It was in the passage from the Gita that I read, you know, very specifically saying you're not running to pleasure and you're not running away from pain. I love that. You've heard me say that over and over again. There's nothing wrong with doing things that feel good. I just said this in a recent program. I know I did. Nothing wrong with that. The problem is when you're running away from this that feels bad to get to this that feels good, that's attachment. It's a problem. It's a problem because attachment keeps you here indefinitely, right? And so for people will say, I'm in such pain, I'm in such pain. I can't stand it. I don't think I can take it. And I'll look at them and say, well, then why are you playing around? Get serious about your work. If you're in pain and you want it to stop, well, do your work because that's the only thing that's going to bring you what it is you're really looking for. Or do you just want to perpetuate the story of your own suffering? Are you getting some kind of positive feedback that strokes the ego if I get into the story with you and say, oh, you poor thing, that was really terrible. I'm so sorry that that happened to you. And wow, no one deserves that kind of thing. And must have been really hard. Must have been really hard. That's not serving you. You're not here to be the best victim in the world. You're here to transcend your whole belief in victimhood, period. Remember, like I said in the beginning of the program, you set yourself up for this. Every single piece of it. All of the people in your outside world, all of their quirks, all of their problems, all of their, you know, issues. It's all you. You brought it all to yourself because it was part of what you needed. In order for you to see past all of it, to transcend the need to continue to return, you've brought it all to your doorstep. And God allows it because it's the ultimate show of love. Parents understand this. Is it love when you stop a child from falling, when you stop a child from making their mistake? Or is it love when you allow for it to happen because you understand that the only way that child will move into greater wisdom is to stumble and fall once in a while. Every parent knows that. Now someone's going to say, well, you don't let your kid touch a hot stove. Okay, obviously, right? Some things you do stop when your kid's about to jump off the deck because they think they can fly, you know. Maybe you stop that one. But you understand the point. The point is a parent's love understands that pain sometimes has to come with it. That child's sense of personal suffering is sometimes a necessary thing on their path of greater evolution. And you are on your own path of greater evolution. And God loves you as itself, beyond your capacity to even remotely understand what that looks like. You have the entire universe, seen and unseen, to explore as God. Yeah, you've chosen to take a diversion for a while. It's okay. It's not permanent. The question is, how soon do you want to go back to your normal functioning? Right? And the answer to that lies within you. It's your choice. You get to make your choice. You can play the game as long as you want, or you can decide, okay, enough is enough. So maybe I have depressive disorder, but you know what? I'm going to stop being a depressive labeled person today. I don't want to be labeled that way. No, I don't have depression. I'm not suffering from depression. I'm not a survivor of depression. It was something that I labeled for a long time, but you know what? It's not me. It's not me. Because I'm not any of it. You're not any of the ego, and you're not any of the stories. You are God. You are love. You are eternal. I think that's a good note to end it on tonight, yeah? Okay. Thank you all for being with me tonight. And I look forward to seeing you next week for Satsang. Good night, everyone. You are divine.